All right, you know what day it is, you know what time it is. Let's just get to it, you know, the first day of the week. This is it, Sunday. I just want to let everybody know that I, the boss, believe that Sunday is the first day of the week. That Saturday, that Friday and Saturday are the days in which we give praise, and Sunday is when we get busy. So with that, I'm going to get busy. You know, there's a lot of things in the news. I got to get to it because last week I told you, I said, you know, I said, if one can just follow it, if they just follow it. Now, you remember the Valerie flame and the whole thing. It's all being inflamed as we speak. Yes, great Scott. But anyhow, before I get to that, let me do my little bit of housekeeping here. You're listening to BBSRadio.com, and this is The Boss, and this is Mission Possible Radio Hour. Yes, and I give praise, you know, to the Creator. This is Sunday, the first day, and I like to be the first say. So, you know, I get to do that now, and we'll get to do it more as we begin to do more shows on other networks at that late night hour. I love this night because this is like the opposite of high noon. This is like we're on it, you know, and that's the kind of experience I hope my listeners get when they accidentally or serendipitously or willfully tune into the Mission Possible Radio Hour. Tonight I'm kind of excited because I really want to get to some things that are important to me. As you know, for those of you who are regular listeners, that I am very much into exploring the past to understand my present so that I can chart a future. And that means this is that I am in a position to be on the right path. And all along the way, I get signs. And it is the same for all of you out there. It's just that as you begin to hone in and you realize, and it becomes so quickly, you realize, I'm on the wrong path. Or, I'm on the right path. Give glory to God. You know, my father, Dangerous George Williams, who was a community activist in San Francisco, a long time ago, passed away in 1994. He is a man who left me with a song that I guess I'll take the time to share with you. This is another way that I can show you how we in my family and within the faith in the family that we celebrate the great causes of the Most High. And that is that we give glory to God every day, you know, and that's what's most important. When you do that, all that is happening in your life fails in comparison. And we have a song. It's called Good Morning, DG. And I thought perhaps just so that I could share with you what this awesome feeling is to wake up in the morning and look at the sun. It goes like this. Good morning, DG, and thank you for the glory of the sun. And thank you for the help I have to get my duty done. I shall devote the hours of this golden day to you, by honoring your holy name in everything I do. I shall pursue my daily art without complaint or fear, and spend my every effort to be friendly and sincere. I know there have been many days I whiled away, but this is one I want to try and make your special day. And so once more, good morning, DG, and please depend upon me, because I want to honor you for all eternity. Good morning, DG, and thank you for the glory of the sun. And thank you for the help I have, and bless the Lord for the help I have to get my duty. Good morning, DG. Yeah, good morning, DG. Dangerous George, or in terms of, because he is the man who gave it to me, I believe that when he wrote it, he was saying, dear God, and when we can give it up to God first thing. So first thing this morning, here it is, midnight. Hi, midnight. A lot of you just getting ready to do that thing. A lot of you already up doing it already. Give it up to God. Take the time, you see, to really tap in to those words. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Thank God for the heaven. Thank God for the earth. First words in the Bible. Yes. And now the Bush says we can open up that other book. He says that democracy allows us to open up that other book. Lord have mercy, when you go to that book, what does it instill in you? That book that came after, just a little bit more of God's instruction, the fear of God. Yes, the Bible begins with the living and all-powerful, all-wise God who has the power to create, to make things from nothing. Now, that brings me to my second point. My Father, who established saying, we the unwilling, who have been led by the unqualified, have been doing the unbelievable for so long, with so little, we now attempt to do the impossible with nothing. That statement is all wise as a memory of that which is the truth, that the all-wise God has the power to create, to make things from nothing. And the fear of God, which according to the writers of Proverbs in the Old Testament, says it is the beginning of wisdom, you see. To have this is to have a restraint, to have a guard on one's tongue and on one's hand and on one's heart from evil, never wanting to fall from righteousness, wanting to always be seen in good conduct. All of these ideas are implied in this one word, God. You know, this is the book. This is the book that he now allows us to open up, which is that we must fear God. This is where we are going wrong. This is the highest love. This is what you learn. It's the secret to success. And success leaves clues. And those clues are within the Son of Man. Now, why is the boss, who usually is going political, talking to you like this? Well, think about it. How delicious it is that as we go into this undecided Democratic primary and already decided Republican primary, where all is going to be nice and neat, the discussions about where and how and who and how one conducts themselves in faith is up underneath the microscope. Glory, hallelujah to that. Because it makes it news, and therefore it makes it fair game for the boss to be talking about it because it's in the news. And I look back to my other shows, and I remember telling you this whole race started with them in church. Everybody was going to church. Mitt Romney was going to church. John McCain was in church. Everybody was caught in God's good favor. And as they did that, it all got left behind. And then up jumped the right one. And then the moth. Now you're talking. Because when I looked and I saw how this story continued. Now what am I talking about? For those of you who are into discursive thought, you know what I'm talking about. I'm talking about Obama now being churchless. Saying that he has to leave his church. Because it pains him to have his church up underneath such scrutiny that it is disturbing his church and that he'd like them to get back to their kind of worship. And I remember saying, what is the whole idea here about having a God in the first place is to fear that God and to fear that you should do something to fall out of good favor. It guards us. It is the consciousness that's speaks. Oh, yes, there's an override button. Oh, yes, there's a defense mechanism against that word. And now we have antidepressants that you can take that can cut that voice off. Oh, my goodness. Or turn that voice on and tell you, yes, you can go out and get that job. Yes, you can get that driver's license. Yes, you can pass that SAT score, whatever it is. But I All my life have depended upon the faith of God to get me through the day, to always be there for me. And that I will do everything in my power and to do and to make sure that I don't disconnect. Disconnect. What is a congregation? Have we heard from that congregation? Why was that congregation disturbed in the first place? And was it really disturbed, or is this how it is, business doing business, and this is the way they talk? But it ain't cool once you got one that's trying to be the leader. Now he got to be something else. I don't know what the deal is, but it's kind of freaky, and it all kind of is ecumenical in its giving. So I just wanted to put it out there that, you know, let's look at this whole thing. There was a time when churches get zero tax, you know, credit, and they don't pay no taxes, and they get tithes from their people. And the whole deal here is you go ahead and deal with God and let man deal with man. Now, when you look at Jesus Christ and you look at the Christian faith and you look at it all, and when you look at Jesus Christ, you say, oh, well, he went to great lengths to say he wasn't of this kingdom. So therefore, what applied to you in terms of the law of Caesar did not apply to him, and he was willing to take the brunt of it, kind of like not wanting to pay your income tax, thinking that you don't have to because there ain't no law that says you have to. I don't know. I know there's a 16th Amendment. Oh, someone help me out here. You know what I'm saying? That's the way it goes. And each chapter of this life begins to just make you perk up and say, oh, it's working, isn't it? Oh, they're being tested. What truly is the message? And this is exactly what it is. It is a testing. It is the opening times. This is it when they come in to sit in the class and the teacher says, okay, put away your books. We're going to have a surprise test. And up it jumps. You're not looking for it. And all of a sudden you got it all in the bag. And here it comes. Someone test your faith. Lord have mercy. Should such a spectacle have happened in a church that I may or may not have, I know exactly how I would have dealt with it. And I know exactly how anybody else faced would have dealt with it. They would have said, this isn't about wrong. It isn't about right. It has to do with what creates value in your life. Had Obama been the kind of individual that we are looking for, the kind of wisdom of Solomon that we are looking for, is that there is no value in this. That, you know, I'm not going to leave my church. You go to church every Sunday, you're going to be a member. And as a member, you stand up in the faith of Jesus Christ and in the faith of your God, and you back that which is evil, if you believe it to be evil, out. You gather the herd together and you protect them from this pernicious thought of belittling or of race baiting and testing the congregation. Its faith is shaky already. It don't need to be tested. And as it is, it draws us into this negative realm. It lets us see things the rest of the country that you didn't know would be. But I told you this, if you listen to my shows, I don't trust Illinois. You know, I don't trust Chicago. I mean, when you really, really think about it, folks, this is like the back end of the front end. And what are we doing here? We got Protestants and Catholics and Mormons and everybody, special interest groups now, the faith-based kind of stuff is going and everything, putting money into campaigns and cajoling their people to support candidates. I'm going to ask you to support God, to please respect God, to begin to look at how all of this has been heralded, has been revealed. And it is up to us to now ask ourselves, what is it are we supposed to do to disengage, disconnect from this rebellion? And that's all I can say it is, a rebellion in heaven and a rebellion here on earth. Oh, yes. And for the first time in my life, I can truly see that there is an invisible government that people are willing to serve. And if they are willing to follow, and that they are willing to be players in the dissonance and the disconnection and disassociation of that which is true, that we have been told to love one another. Where does what Father Michael did have anything to do with love and compassion? Where does it go? What is it for? You know, in one sense, Obama is right. If your church offended, leave it in quiet resignation. But the other side of it is, if you've been a member for 20 years, it is for you to do that which you have sat in the pew to learn to do, which is to not throw the baby out with the bathwater, not to disassociate yourself from God, the church in which you sit, the people that are behind you, the people that have gotten you as far as you've gone, in your faith, and the belief in that faith, and their faith telling their sphere of influence that you're a good man, to not just throw up your hands and leave, to fix it, and to show the world that you can fix it, not to run away and be churchless. Sit in your pew. Fix it. Back them up. You're the President of the United States. Show them how to worship. Show them how to pray. That's what our deal here is. So when our people falter, when they start to get full of themselves, or a little bit arrogant, or forgetting exactly what the example of the one that came to redeem us, oh yeah, I'm political, but I am also very, very much one of the biggest fans of God ever to come along down the pike. And I will not forsake my God for any race. I will not forsake my God for any face. I will not forsake my God for any trace of wealth or position. If it means me having to turn my back on my place of worship. Oh, my goodness. Fix it, Obama. Don't walk away from your church. Fix it. Have the words of wisdom to reach these people. It seems like you're kind of ecumenical in your whole being anyhow. But that's just my slant on it. I'm going to move on because, you know, a lot of people got a lot of things. I just encourage you, if you got God in your heart, then keep listening, folks, because I have it in my heart, and I just find it interesting that this Catholic priest has a church in a black quarter town, St. Sabina's, and that he's the man over there. And then you got, Reverend Moss, and like you say, you can see they're used to this. This is embarrassing for Obama. I can't think that these people just started talking like this when he started running for president. You see, you have to grow up in this kind of situation, and you have to see how it is, and then you have to admit it. That's why I believe that, yes, this is kind of like a school fight, you know, where everybody's standing around. They're not participating directly in the fight, but they're the ones that are sitting around and go, ooh, fight, ooh, look, yeah, yeah, uh-huh, and they're the ones that are encouraging. They're in the circle, and they're enforcing this thing, and I'm just like, hey, congregation, get to it, you know. People get full of themselves, and, you know, poor God take a man out, he make him demented, and I just find it interesting. I don't know if anybody else does. I want to get to something else that's in the news right now that has a lot to do with what I've been talking about. You know, I'm a Bob Woodward freak, and, you know, he was in the news because Scott McClellan's in the news, and I don't know for those of you who may know or not know or care, but that has a lot to do with this here I, Lewis Libby thing and the Valerie flame, and it's starting to inflame again, for lack of a better word. And I just wanted to kind of say to all of you that this book that Scott McClellan has written, it took him 5 years to do this. I'm going to tell you something. People shouldn't ask, why did it take you 5 years to do this? The fact that he's doing it, the fact that it will be supported by the evidence, and the person who will come to the forefront once again is Bob Woodward. Now, again, for those of you people who are too young to remember, if you're listening to this show, Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein, and they're both still alive, and they had a lot to do with this here Watergate thing. It has to do with what journalists do when they're watching Washington, okay? And Bob Woodward, he wrote 3 books. You know, the boss is really into the trilogy, The State of Denial, The Plan of the Attack, and The Commanders. Now, The Commanders was about George Bush's father, the senior, and how he, in 1991, and the whole Gulf War thing, and the whole preemptive strike, and the whole thing. Then we have the sequel to The Commanders, which is Plan of Attack, and then the third book is State of Denial. Now, what I find interesting is that the state of denial, when you think of the word denial, you have to think defense mechanism, such as rationalization, sublimination, overcompensation, and there's a few others. And what they say in the mental health field and in psychiatry and all is that people have to do this in order to defend themselves against just kind of like just going bonkers over the fact that they may or may not have done something, or that something has happened to them. It's a way in which you psychologically cut off the pain that results when you either found out, shame, shock, those kinds of things. Well, anyhow, Bob Woodard's book is called The State of Denial. What Scott McClellan is accusing George Bush Jr. of being is a person who suffers from self-deception. And I would agree terribly with this, and I think that anybody that doesn't agree with it at some point in looking at his life would have to say, that's kind of an interesting perception. And why would it take you 5 years to have to say this, and you're waiting until he's a lame duck kind of like guy going out? I don't know, except for the fact that they're trying to shake it all up. And I thought, maybe it's just so that I get to talk about it again, because it's still so delicious, and it's all so interesting that even now, as Bush has given Libby a pardon and everything, I'm just wondering, because some people lost their lives and the whole thing is still festering and Scott's talking about that, perhaps we need to review it, because here it is now, 2008. But the scene back then was June 12, 2003. And that just happens to also be George Bush Sr.'s birthday. So on his birthday, you can imagine, he opens up the paper. And this really is the way it goes, folks. And this is 5 years to the time, as we're in June now. I'd like to, you know, without getting sued by Bob Woodard, I'm going to read an excerpt that deals specifically with this thing, but I'm going to do it interestingly, because he references Joseph Wilson once in his book, Plan of the Attack, and then he mentions him on two pages, so it gets a little more juicy. And I thought, in order to put it in its context, that we might look at this in a way in which you'd understand. There was a point when the president had decided to give a prime time speech to lay out the case against Saddam. And so he had selected it in Cincinnati, Ohio. And they were writing up drafts, and it says that Steve Hadley and Mark Gearson, and you can type their names in, Steve Hadley and Mike Gearson, G-E-R-S-O-N, was the ones that were working on the speech, okay? And they had made drafts of, and had seen drafts like, and had put in things like, after 1995, Iraq admitted that it had produced 25,000 liters of anthrax and other deadly biological agents. The CIA said the number could increase to 30,000, the number the president would use. What they don't tell you is that a lot of the materials that they were using to make that 25,000 liters of anthrax came from the CIA. You see, so they know that they had it because they gave it to them. You see what I'm saying? And they try to use this stuff. The draft also said that before the 1991 Gulf War, the best intelligence had indicated Iraq was 5 to 7 years away from developing a nuclear weapon. And the CIA recommended changing it to more accurate 8 to 10 years. And the number that Bush would state in his speech, that was 8 to 10 years. So the situation here is that you've got this speech that is being worked on, and draft six, further stated that after the Gulf War, international weapons inspectors had discovered Iraq was much further along in its nuclear program and would likely have had a nuclear weapon within 18 months. The CIA memo suggested that the time frame to be more 2 to 3 years, and Bush settled on a formulation that said no later than 1993. You see what I'm saying? This is how they work. And that was then. So now you have, they have draft six, and it contained a line, and it says, and the regime has been caught attempting to purchase up to 500 metric tons of uranium oxide from sources in Africa, a central ingredient in the enrichment process, unquote. The basis for this was an unsubstantiated report from British intelligence that Iraq had recently attempted to buy uranium oxide, known as yellowcake, from Niger. The CIA was unsure of this for a number of reasons and had shared its concerns with the British. A former ambassador, and here's where the news, Joseph Wilson IV, had been sent to Niger to check out the report and had found nothing to substantiate it. And the CIA memo recommended that any reference be dropped from the Cincinnati speech, and it was. Okay? So now you've got that. The draft said that on Saddam Hussein's orders, opponents have been decapitated, and the CIA had evidence was the opponents had been executed, not decapitated. But decapitated stayed in the final speech. So again, this manipulation of words, this is the deception, this is the self-deception, you see, that they're all practicing, that there is a lie that they are trying to put on us as being the truth. And when it's shaky for them, they have to go through some serious psychological things so that they are able to continue. So you look at the speech, was not carried over the three major broadcasts, but it was seen by like 17 million people, Bob says, on Fox Network and cable news, and you can get it. You can see it. Now, Bush's core argument was that Iraq gathers the most serious danger of our age in one place, and that, quote, the danger is already significant, and it only grows worse with time. It was said, he used things like facing clear evidence of peril. He says, we cannot wait for final proof, the smoking gun, that could come in the form of a mushroom cloud, unquote. So you then see him liken this whole situation to the Cuban Missile Crisis of October 1962. Quote, neither the United States of America nor the world community of nations can tolerate deliberate deception and offensive threats on the part of any nation, large or small. We no longer live in a world where only the actual firing of weapons represents a sufficient challenge to a nation's security to constitute maximum peril, unquote. So the next day that this speech was given, on October 8th, 47 senators were briefed. And they were all shown this national intelligence estimate and the key judgment that Iraq has chemical and biological weapons. And it was Colin Powell who spoke and said, and he said, unless Congress passes the authorization for use of force, the Security Council will find a way to sidestep the issue. You see, all the time. Why am I talking about this? Because truly, these people lied us into a war. And truly, these people put to death a man who is no more guilty of anything than George Bush is guilty of anything, as Pinochet is guilty of anything, or any of the dictators, Somoza, or any of them that you can think of are guilty. This is incredible, America. And America, you got to do something about it, because the president lied, and all the people around him lied, and they're all steeped in self-deception, and they're practicing cognitive dissonance. And this is the way it is, and you can't expect much from it. You cannot expect much from it. So I say to you, what are we doing? Well, let's move along. Let's just move along. And we see in this, we see hypnotized senators speaking for and against it. We have people who, I don't care what you say, we're going to do this. We have people like my son, who is Feinstein. She's still there. She was four. But what we are talking about here is that somebody gave that man in the office now a blank check to wage a war upon a group of people based upon some seriously weak evidence. So therefore, they was able to do this thing and then cover the evidence up. This is the familiar way in which these cowboys work. What are we to do about it? Well, there's an office of special counsel, Fitzgerald, you know, Patrick Fitzgerald. But where is he from? He's from Chicago. You know, I'm trying to understand, you know, it's all good, but it all doesn't work for me. I don't know if it works for you folks, but it don't work for me. So I want you to watch that story because it gets good, folks. And even in, you know, the time that that Bob wrote the book Plan of the Attack, and he mentions it just as a byline, it gets even better when you jump to his most recent book, or the what I call the last of his trilogy. It then runs it like this. So you haven't got much more going. You got this book he wrote in 2004, which is not a long time ago, you know, in terms of really knowing. And that's the whole point, is to be able to see and to see it all and to take advantage of the interviews and the things that are said and cross-referencing. So they don't expect us to do this kind of work. So now we have Scott McClellan, who is accusing our president of self-deception, of lying, about misleading us into this war. And so I thought it'd be kind of fun to then look at, well, what's Bob saying now that he done wrote the state of denial? Well, I found this. It says, on June 12, 2003, that's George Bush's birthday, the Washington Post ran a front-page story by Walter Pincus reporting that an unnamed retired U.S. ambassador had been sent to Africa in 2002 to see if Iraq had tried to get uranium from Niger. The retired ambassador disputed that there was any evidence of a deal. This ran contrary to President Bush's assertion in his State of the Union address before the war. In 16 words that would become famous, quote, the British government has learned that Saddam Hussein recently sought significant quantities of uranium from Africa. 16 words stated the next day, a Friday, I interviewed, and this is Bob Woodard talking, I interviewed a senior administration official, someone who did not work in the White House, for my book, Plan of Attack. Now, Plan of Attack is the book that I just read you that just had the one small paragraph. Now it's back in, what is copyright? Let me take a second here and look at the copyright so I can really give you an idea of how it all works and how Bob this time says, no, this is even bigger. This will take you back to Watergate if you really look at it, because this is just how they work. Let's see, the copyright for this is 2004 that he published the book Plan of the Attack. So when he was working on that book, which would take you a little bit beyond that time, take some time to read the book, the next day, a Friday, I interviewed a senior administration official, someone who did not work in the White House, for my book, Plan of Attack. Near the end of the 1 hour and 30-minute background interview, our conversation drifted to a gossipy interchange that is common after a long, substantive discussion. I said I knew the retired U.S. ambassador on the CIA mission was Joseph C. Wilson, who had been ambassador to the African country of Gabon under George Herbert Walker Bush, and who had worked on the Clinton National Security Council. His wife, quote, his wife works in the agency, unquote, the official said. Quote, she is a WMD, Weapons of Mass Destruction Analyst out there, unquote. He said Wilson's wife had proposed him for the mission because Wilson knew Africa. We moved on to another subject. After the interview, I told Pincus what I had heard about Wilson's wife working as a weapons of mass destruction analyst at the CIA without saying who I had learned it from. Pincus later said he did not recall our conversation. Now, who's Pincus? Well, he's at the Washington Post, too. You can look him up, Walter Pincus. Just type his name into the search engine and educate yourself once more. The Washington Post is in the middle of it all, and it all goes all the way up to the highest of the highest of the unholy of the unholy. A few weeks later, on July 6th, Wilson wrote an op-ed piece in the New York Times and said it was highly doubtful that any Iraq-Niger deal had taken place. 8 days after that, syndicated columnist Robert Novak wrote that two senior administration officials had told him that Wilson's wife, Valerie Flame, was a CIA operative on weapons of mass destruction and had been instrumental in his going to Africa. The Justice Department launched a criminal investigation into how Wilson's wife's CIA ties were revealed to the press and whether it meant an undercover agent had been revealed. A special prosecutor was soon named to take over the investigation, U.S. Attorney Patrick Fitzgerald of Chicago. Now, I know you say, well, boss, so what is that about? I see. Don't you just think it's kind of interesting that it's Chicago? You know? So you look at all of this and then you look at the fact that the senator from Illinois lives in Chicago. And you start to say to yourself, boy, this is a heck of a story. You know? Because out of the whole big melting pot that we call America, these guys can dip in there and find some of the most smallest of the insignificant radioisotopic situations or solutions that they could possibly find that was only going to take us further and further into fascism and totalitarianism, as to bring up from the bottom of that barrel the people who are running for president right now. I can only tell you this, that until they stand up and they tell the truth about everything that has gone on before this, and how they have wasted and squandered all of our money, I don't want them to fix nothing. I want them to admit to something. And that's the hardest thing of all to do. And that's where the whole idea, and I can then switch gears, because you can see how, my goodness, how could the president lie like this? Well, it's easy. He's trained to. And the way they do that is that there have been many, many people throughout the world who have trained people to lie, to fix it in their head that what they are saying is true and that you don't have to worry, I'm not lying to you, because I believe what I'm saying. And the way you get to believe what you're saying is to truly work it out. And the way you work it out is with help. Now, people talk about self-deception, and there's lots of examples. The best place to go is to just type in self-deception and see where it takes you. And when you do, you find that you're coming into this place where it's actually a defense that people put up. It's a fence. And what they do is they convince themselves that what they are saying is the truth. So therefore, when they are presented with opposition, they can continue to repeat what it is they know to be the truth. That's it. And as it shakes them and as you see them start to fall apart, they have what's called this need to go within and defend themselves, put a cloak around it. And so what you have is denial, what you have is rationalization, what you have is projection. A good example of projection is a person who is caught stealing, why are you making such a big thing out of it? Everybody steals. I have to say that everybody steals to make themselves feel good so that they don't feel like, there's something wrong with me, I can't stop stealing. Well, everybody steals, you see. It doesn't do anything for the problem, it just makes you feel better. And so, and when I hear Scott McCollum saying to me, oh, the President of the United States suffers terribly from self-deception, I'm like, oh my goodness, what a apropos. And why does it take you so long? Well, see, this is what happens when people want to make a paycheck, when they want to be successful. They have a tendency to accept a lesser degree of notoriety later on because they do things that are not to the liking of. And you know who we're supposed to be pleasing. And it's funny because it's going to bring everybody down because they're telling on each other now. Now, why would they be telling on each other? Why would all this be happening now? Well, I believe it is because John McCain is shaking the tree. And see, when they decide that they have to sacrifice one, they eat each other, you see what I'm saying? So I believe that this may be coming, all of this and the book and everything, is coming in a way to help the John McCain, how you say, the John McCain campaign, which is to win at any cost. But if we don't win, then it's to go back and to do whatever we can do to upset the apple cart. And they have a lot of things in place that they can do. You see, it's going to take us a lot, no matter who it is, whoever it is. And let's just make the assumption that Obama is truly... It's hard for me to do, but it's truly his own man. Yeah, I find that that probably, too, would have to be truly steeped in self-deception. I don't know, but that would only come from really sitting down and talking to the man, and chances of the boss getting to talk to Barack Obama probably slim and none. But it's a process, all right. And again, you know, Bob Woodard, he named his book Denial, State of Denial, and that's what self-deception is. It's a process of denying, of rationalizing away something that's significant, that opposes what you believe to be true, you see. And no matter how much evidence is given to you, you still believe it to be true. This is what happened. This is how we got into a preemptive strike. This is how he gave himself permission to go to Congress and to ask for the money and to ask for the permission. We are still in shock. He's pushing us around. We're all in self-deception. We all believe the story about the jet fuel until some people come along and they say, wait a minute, folks, will you wake up? Will you look at all these charges? Will you look at all this? Will you look at all these implosions of other buildings? Does this look like it burned? Does this look like it blew up? Does this look like it just was an ordinary thing? Look at here. Plane crashes with no planes, no luggage, not a trace. Oh, they've got us. Self-deception? For the president to come on and tell us to get back to normal 5 hours after it happened? Deception? To self-deceive? Of course you have to do this. This is what happens. You see, the lie is the abstraction. It's the mental process. It's what creates, it's that which helps you to create the lie. You see, the lie is not a real thing. You have to create it. You see, this is the opposite of what God does. This is Satan's work. Satan has to create the lie. And if we are to believe and to have faith in the idea that there is an eternal struggle between God and this entity called Satan, which I consider to be stupid, that our brains and our heart and our soul struggle to keep from abstracting our idea of thinking about the truth, which then becomes a deception. In other words, we are distancing ourselves. This is a way for us to put an end to things. Hello?
Hello, Rev.
Hey, is that Don?
Yes, it is.
How am I doing?
You're doing great. You've been working.
I've been working. Listen, what? Piggyback. Pick it up.
I didn't call to interrupt your flow.
What'd you call for then?
Just to congratulate you on your research.
Oh. Well, expound on me, because I'm in the spirit, so I never know what it is I'm saying that someone finds to be absolutely right on. I'm not quite sure, Don. What part of what I said got you?
Everything. You had just mentioned possibly interviewing Barack Obama.
Uh-huh.
I don't think that's going to happen.
Yeah, I don't think it'll happen either.
I think that's admirable of you to espouse that, but I don't think it's going to happen. You put him on the spot. And after what I have researched, heads have to turn around in a circle, in a complete circle.
Yeah, there's something going on here. I can't put my finger on it, you know, but every time Chicago or Illinois, you know, I got a lot of history with Chicago and Illinois in terms of all their double thinking and distancing from the Constitution and all, and, you know, Mayor Daley and that whole thing and the Black Panther. I just got a bad feeling about the whole thing, and then the way the whole church thing is going on there, the Catholic Church and the Protestants and everybody's being shown up. What do you make of all of that? You know, because
the way I see the church thing, it's a diversion to cause people to look away from the real facts. And this will become clear to you this month. I can only say. We're putting one hell of a piece together for the Idaho Observer. And we're going to release the second half of the McCain genealogy and the Barack Obama, space permitting.
I hope you go ahead and do it, because we can't put truth off much longer, you know.
No,
we do, I'd rather just have it all hit the fan now. I pray hard all the time. So if we have all the pieces, because Lord knows I have a lot of pieces that I keep. I just, there's some about this man, and some about all of them, but because I've searched Hillary ever since, you know, she showed up, as the wife of Bill Clinton, and I kept looking at this powerful woman and saying, how does she get this way? And, you know, I like to study how people ascend to the throne, you know, in a way in American politics and work, and how the invisible government selects these people. And she's always been a kind of but she also starts out in Chicago. They all put them in Chicago. And then I think about Rockefeller and the University of Chicago, and I think about that whole area, and I go, boy, if there ever was a fascist plot, it would be hatched either in New York or in Chicago.
Yeah, it's the seat of organized crime. It's the seat of judicial corruption.
And serious church money, too.
Well, yeah, you gotta look beyond the churches. It doesn't have anything to do with churches.
Well, I meant the Vatican money.
Yes.
Not these little churches. I'm not that. They all been absorbed. But I'm talking about some serious church banking goes on in Illinois.
Yeah.
You know?
Pardon my ignorance or my naivete.
No, that's okay, because, you know, it's so convoluted, it's so hard for us as researchers to even begin. You know, we get into different pockets, but that's something a lot of people don't really know about, is how much of the Vatican's money is funneled through Chicago. And somehow or another, Don, I am smelling the Vatican in all of this election.
Well, you were very right. They're in most of them, too, if not all of them. All I can say is who this man is presented as representing, and who he really is night and day. And it will become very clear. The Lord, as you mentioned prayer, I pray a lot when I do my research, before I start it, during it, and after. And I pray that the doors open up, that the light shines in the darkness, and that all is revealed. And believe you me, it's being revealed to me. And it's going to blow some minds.
Well, I think that, you know, when I read your Otto Scorsese thing, I said, oh, you travel in the same circles. And I realize also is that as we begin to educate the public, and that's what I'm hoping we really get to do on these terminologies, we can begin to look at these people and their offsprings and see how the work is continued decade after decade after decade, that they never quit,
mm-hmm.
that they never stop.
And you have spoken often, I've heard you speak about the Illuminati bloodlines, as they like to call it, and they like to create their own kind in their own manner. Now, how it gets represented to us is a very convoluted method, or in a convoluted fashion, that it's very difficult, if not impossible, to trace how they do these things. But they make mistakes. They are so arrogant and blatantly careless about how they do it that the clues are there. And it's a bloodline thing with all three of these candidates. I'm proving that. I've already proven it, although the second half of the McCain article is yet to be published. And I will show that with Barack Obama, and I will show that with Hillary Clinton.
Well, you know, it's kind of interesting because, you know, I was looking at the McCain site, and I had looked at it before, and I never saw mention of his European roots or his genealogical background that goes back to some Scottish king. He has it on his website, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't always there.
Yeah, but it's not, well, but it's also not like I describe it. It's supposedly through an American generation after generation. There's this lineage that was supposedly created in Mississippi, which is a total fiction. It's a total fiction. And the bloodline is straight from the King of England, Edward VII. Straight from, but they didn't come here with real names. They came here with aliases. And they even changed their British aliases. I say British, the United Kingdom, actually Scottish.
And the time in which they did that would be in the early 1800s, this plan goes back to?
Well, this whole plot began in 1865 as far as the birth of McCain's grandfather. However, I have discovered pretty convincing proof that the plot was hatched in 1860 when Albert Edward, who was then the Prince of Wales, Duke of Rothesay and Cornwall, came to Canada and the United States, spending 3 days with James Buchanan at the White House. That was the time they put this plot together. And then 5 years later, he had an illegitimate child, and that became John McCann, who then had his name changed in 1924 to John McCain. And I tracked all the shipping records, ships, cruise lists, and passenger lists, and found definitive evidence that they were already in the country by 1892. And that the man that was put into the U.S. Navy was put in the U.S. Navy at age 59, a very unlikely time to enlist in the Navy, wouldn't you say?
So these are like agent provocateurs.
Yes.
That this really actually goes into the whole idea of going all the way back to like 1832 when the Germans and the Austrians and the Prussians were all vying for power and starting all of these, Skull and Bones and different organizations and brother organizations in Europe, that after the Revolution, they had to get back in tow and to get their hands around corporations. And they pretty much had the cooperation of the American families that were here. So this is another way of saying that this conspiracy goes back a long way.
Mm-hmm.
and that somebody at the top in the invisible government is keeping tabs on it all.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. But you should see the dimension that it's grown to. And you will see this with, not just with the McCains, you'll see this with Obama and Clinton. Definitely you will see this with Obama. I mean, where did this guy come from? He just came out of nowhere. And you are going to be shocked. I'm going to tell you.
Well, it takes a lot for me to be shocked.
You will be shocked.
But I do like a good thriller. And it seems to me that this is, I would like to see you upset the apple cart, Don Nicolas.
There is
I really would. Huh?
There is no apple cart.
Yeah.
It's just applesauce in a bucket right now.
Well, you know, I am looking forward to working with you and putting our new radio show together.
Me too.
I'm not sure when we are scheduled to go on, but I'm not going to let everybody know. But with the magic of ideas and you filling in and Len and all, it seems like we've hit some magic here and are going to try and put something together.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm looking forward to that. I find that we need to encourage more people to do their research and come on, folks, you know, and really tell it like it T.I. is. Because all the pieces, they all come together. And talking to Don, he's an excellent researcher. You know, you may have a piece of the puzzle that fits with his puzzle that takes us to the next level, that takes us. We know where we're headed. All the way to the top. And I won't be satisfied until we have the man at the top and we can get him to repent and to tell the truth so that we can get to fixing this whole thing. You know?
Yeah.
And I'm not sure that's Obama.
Oh, well, trust me. Trust me, Rev. What is going to come out is quite a different story from what's being told. And what has been told.
Yeah, about him being from Hawaii and the whole thing.
Well, about everything.
Because he's only 40. How old is he? He's only 46 or so. I mean, he couldn't have lived that. I mean, it takes time to even get into the situation. Like, you know, you got to go to school.
Mm-hmm.
Then you got to be educated.
Mm-hmm.
Then you got to go out and you got to make a living. And it's that period of time that I'm finding hard, that they're not really talking about. They're always talking about, oh, he's been friends with this one for a long time. He's been friends with that one for a long time. And I'm only 56 years old, but I know that my friends that I have, they're not all of them, they're acquaintances, and I only see them every now and then and in this room or that room. I wouldn't consider these people to be my Boone Coon friends. So when they introduced Father Michael from St. Sabina as being a long-time friend of Obama's, when you talk about him being a long-term member of this church, which is uniquely black, I mean, they stand on it. They're unashamed of being black. You see what I'm saying? And
mm-hmm.
And this church is a black church. And when you think about this, you say, are these people behaving normally
mm-hmm.
or are they behaving abnormally?
Mm-hmm.
Is this the type of church that he went to that didn't that talked about people and made fun of them from the pulpit and talked about America and how it's going to go down, which is, to me, you know, that's the crossover. You know, I try to, when I am preaching, to stick with the word, all right? And then when I am not preaching, I'm teaching, I may use America as an example of how it is either Antichrist or going along with the Christian
mm-hmm.
Christ values. You know, the man. I'm talking
yeah.
about the man. What would Jesus do?
Well, while they have the attention on Reverend Wright, it's taking the attention off the fact that several members of that church have died under very suspicious circumstances.
No kidding.
Oh, yes. One of the organists from the keyboard player, I presume he was a pianist, an organist died, and I know his first name is Donald. I remember that, and I heard Larry Sinclair talk about that. Do you know who Larry Sinclair is?
No.
Larry Sinclair is a self-proclaimed homosexual lover of Barack Obama.
No kidding.
And described.
And when was this? When he was in school?
Oh no, this was around 1997 that this
no
occurred.
No kidding.
And
now where'd they dig him up from?
Oh well, he's been interviewed by Jeff Rentz 3 or 4 times already. He's started a website, and he's described crack smoking. Obama smokes crack. Sinclair says he himself does not. He just snorts cocaine. And they've met. They've had sex in a limousine. They've had sex in a hotel and at Sinclair's apartment. And that Obama sometimes even surprises him, and comes to visit him, bearing gifts. We'll say. There's a former gay musician at the church in Chicago who died under very mysterious circumstances about the time Larry Sinclair came out with this story. Allegedly, Larry Sinclair feels that they also had a relationship, and that he was going to expose this to the church. Now, they claim Obama went to this church for 20 years. His biographies say he began going to the church in 1992. So that's only 16 years. That's not 20 years. Already there's a lie. And the media says 20 years, 20 years, 20 years. But officially, Obama's biographies state that he joined the church around the time he got married. So... Well, there are many, many inconsistencies to what he says, and some will blow your mind. It'll blow everybody's mind. I have to tell you, it blew my mind.
Wow. It's saying here, I was just, you know, because the beautiful thing about doing this radio show is sometimes when someone gives you something, you can just kind of run over and see what's going on. But Larry got a post here for June 1st, 2008,
mm-hmm.
and he is saying... Which one will expose Obama first? Now, it's not just that I objected to. I also, I don't know if you've done any research, it's how he lives and where he lives and how he got the house he got.
Oh, you haven't heard the half of it yet.
I do a lot more praying these
mm-hmm.
days, you know, and I let you, since I met you, I let you and... do all of this work. You seem to be diligent at it. I'm just loving it. I listen to the show and I say, go Don. Just go ahead, dig it up, Don. That's what I like to call you. I tell my friends, dig it up, Don. That's Don Nikoloff.
Well, it's known that Tony Rezko, who he did some work for, Rezko is a guy that bought the adjacent land to this $1.6 million house he bought, Barack bought in Kenwood. Excuse me, that was a slip.
Hello?
Another caller.
You have another caller? Hello, Don?
I'm still here.
Oh.
Oh, okay. Maybe they're telling us it's time to quit. I don't know.
Sorry, I looked at the news. Thank you, Don. Let me sign off.
Oh.
Don,
okay.
We got to go.
Okay, right.
Hang up.
All right, we'll talk
All right,
soon.
Thank you, Don.
All right.
Well, okay.
Right,
we're 5 minutes late. I got to go. Sorry about that, folks. Sometimes when I get to talking to Don, I just get caught off time. 7:05, sorry, I apologize to whoever's next, and it'll never happen again. Goodbye, everybody. This is Boss RJ, Mission Possible. Bye.